Welcome to Anchorage Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated in the studios of KAKM. The host and moderator for Anchorage Edition is Michael Carey.
Welcome. Our guests are Steve McDonald of Channel 2 News, Matt Felling of Channel 11, and Libby Casey of APRN. Steve, fill the boot. The Anchorage Assembly overturns Mayor Sullivan's veto. What happened and why?
And who thought this would be the big political showdown of the year? But it certainly has turned out that way. The Assembly some time ago approved an ordinance that would make it ethical for employees, municipal employees, on the time clock to go out and help charitable organizations. The mayor vetoed this ordinance and felt it would cause the city a lot of trouble should it proceed. And a rare overturn of the veto occurred on Tuesday night. On a vote of 8-3, the assembly overturned what the mayor did. So now it basically puts the ordinance back in play. The mayor still has a say in all of this. He gets a chance now to write the policy for which will govern the municipal employees and how they carry out their charitable work.
Steve, isn't it a standard maxim in politics? Don't pick a fight you can't win.
Well, yeah, and you'd also hope that, you know, you want your political leaders to stick to their principles and stick to their guns, and I think that's what the mayor did here. This is a tough one, though, to tackle because this is a 20-year tradition in Anchorage. It really is something that I think people look forward to. There are firefighters who, if you're not familiar with the Fill the Boot fundraiser, it's the Anchorage Fire Department. In their regalia, they go out through some busy intersections at around rush hour, and they have their boots and ask motorists to fill them up with money, and it goes to the Muscular Dystrophy Association. It's a huge part of their fundraising effort. This money goes to help people with medical costs, help people with camps.
$100,000,
I believe. Oh, about $130,000, something to that effect. Yeah.
In the Fill the Boot, I think it takes about $115,000, might have been the total intake, and it represents about 70% of that. I might have the number slightly off.
Yeah.
But you're right, you don't fight firefighters and you don't fight footwear either, especially with a story that sounds like it's a Canadian newscaster's dream, Fill the Boot. But you're right, this is the story is not technically over. The override just mainly says it's going to be taken on a case-by-case basis from this point forward. And now, if you want to go out and do a charity on the city's time, you have to either get the mayor's approval or the assembly's approval. So sort of the way this plays out is, yes, he gets to write the verbiage, but at the same time, there's also that little wiggle room,
Do we know, Matthew, how this is going to play out with an entity like the United Way?
No.
But that's in the workplace as well.
Absolutely. And I think this is a Sullivan tradition. Sullivan's father was fine with this. And I think that maybe he's taken enough political flack on it where he has just seen, listen, United Way, it's tough to fight these philanthropic organizations. It's tough to fight these causes that almost everybody can agree on, no matter what side you stand
right.
on Sullivan.
Yeah.
And this might be the end of charity, questioning charity timing in terms of work hours on the clock.
Matthew, let's stick with you. Resign. Governor Parnell's rivals call on his energy advisor, Gene Theriault, to resign because it was improperly appointed. And what do you know? Theriault resigns this week. Explain this to us.
Well, also, Harry Crawford, who has his own political objectives, of course.
Running
against Don Young. He also came out swinging on Monday night. I talked to him, and he said this means if he wants to do the right thing, Gene Theriault's just got to resign. He admitted that he wasn't best of friends with him, but I don't think that they're going to send Christmas cards any longer. And then just yesterday, we're taping this on a Friday, of course, just yesterday, Gene finally sends in his letter of resignation to the governor. And this comes on the heels of the Nancy Dahlstrom story, where she was appointed.
A similar story.
A very similar timing, very similar situation in terms of the governor making appointments to create to positions created. And I talked with Con Bundy this week, and it seems to be a two-dimensional story. From what I've been told, the legislators put this law into effect to make sure that lawmakers could not create these positions down in Juneau and then suggest themselves to the governor for the position. And It had nothing to do with the governor unilaterally deciding, hey, Gene, come on over, let's talk energy. Hey, Nancy, let's talk military. That was the way Con Bundy was parsing the language. So it gives a little bit of wiggle room, but at the same time, it's very unseemly. They didn't take into effect the letter of the law because they all understood the spirit of it. It was one of those odd little schisms.
Well, I think all these political figures understood that it had been done before, and people who got those jobs had performed them, and while there might have been some griping, nobody lost their job.
No, you're absolutely right. The first time this came around with the Nancy Dahlstrom story, I called a couple of lawmakers, and they said, well, yeah, that's just the way it's done. But then if you study and scrutinize the language, of course, you start
this
realizing...
This is just Alaska. We're all good friends around here.
Nothing to see here, folks. Nothing going on. So it was one of those stories which was fed along by certain other media outlets.
And of course,
media outlets who just wanted to kick it around.
A campaign year in the middle of the campaign, 6 weeks or less, four weeks before an election. Okay, Steve, just how vulnerable is Governor Parnell here? Because he would insist and has, I did everything I could to follow the standard procedures to be alerted in this matter.
Right. He went to the Department of Law, and he was basing his decision, he says, on a ruling made by an assistant attorney general who said, you know, yeah, you can do this. You might want to change the job description. You want to make sure that the person who's going to fill the position is certainly out of the legislature. You want to change the all the other paperwork that goes along with this job, make sure that it's a fresh new kind of job. So he's going on that. And then later on, he got another opinion from Dan Sullivan, the attorney general, who said, you know, you're vulnerable here on this in terms of a court case. In terms of the election, I think they cut their losses. And I'm guessing that Senator Terrio and Representative Dahlstrom probably said, you know, you got to win the election. So, we're going to end this right here. So the bleeding stops at that point. He's already heard about it from people like Bill Walker and Ralph Samuels, who are running against him in the Republican nomination. Ethan Berkowitz certainly has weighed in. All those guys are going to take a shot at him. He's run a brilliant race. He's the front runner. He's raised the most money, and he's less than, you know, he's stayed low in the foxhole. He's not much of a target, which is what a front runner should do. You just don't make yourself available to get pummeled by your opponents. This makes him a little bit of a target. Whether it's enough to change the outcome of this election, I don't think so. But
well, the question,
I also think the spotlight, I mean, is on Parnell in this story, of course, but it also, it's widened a bit. There is a little bit of collateral damage. Dan Sullivan, the attorney general, yes, it might have been somebody underneath him who took a look at this situation and gave it the thumbs up, gave it that if nothing but a yellow light. Proceed with caution.
Do some things.
Do some things,
okay.
But be careful about it. Dan Sullivan said okay to the Dahlstrom, Terrio. At the end of the day, it's his office. And also, I mean, it goes back to the healthcare reform where he sat on his hands for a couple weeks, tried to figure out, take the temperature and see, is healthcare reform constitutional? And he stepped out on a number of planks this year and hasn't always ended up in a great situation. So there's a lot of stories at work here at the same time.
And Attorney General Sullivan might be prepared to be looking for work next year. I'm not predicting that would happen, but it really wouldn't be surprising
not
if that
whatsoever.
Was the outcome. Yeah. Okay, let's get Libby Casey in here. Libby, the governor's office comes out swinging against Senator Begich's Arctic Citizens Advisory Council. Senator Begich wants to have on the North Slope and in the seas of the North the same kind of advisory council that we have around Valdez and in Prince William Sound. What did Begich propose? And when Parnell came out swinging, what did he say?
Well, Senator Begich has a number of items he's been advocating for Alaska and the Arctic specifically since he's been in office. And now that there's this oil spill legislation in play, he's realized it's an opportunity to get some of these on the table and incorporate some of his ideas into oil spill legislation going forward. So this advisory council is something that he put up for consideration in the Commerce Committee this week, which has been hammering out its own version of a spill bill. And as you said, Michael, it would create this Citizens Advisory Council for the Arctic, so people there could weigh in on development. And Begich says this would cut down on litigation. You know, he says those lawsuits that go forward have been slowing development in the Arctic repeatedly. And he says by giving citizens a voice up front, you can deal with those conflicts and differences at the initial stages, taking away some of the heat and disagreement. And he points to how well the councils have worked in places like Prince William Sound. But the governor's office came out this week with this press release directly criticizing Begich's plan, and it said that it would actually create another layer of review and oversight and, oh no, extra expense for the oil and gas industry, which, of course, we do not want to scare away in Alaska. And, you know, the governor's office says what's different in this is that the governor would not appoint the members, which he does in the other citizen advisory groups. Instead, these new group members would be appointed federally, and that gives the feds more control over the state. And I spoke with the governor's special advisor, Joe Balash, this week, and he said they're worried this would disrupt the state's authority and actually increase the risk of lawsuits. Well, Senator Begich disagrees and says development's gone forward in places like Cook Inlet. The council there hasn't stopped it. And so he thinks it would open up communication. What's sort of just as interesting as the difference of opinion on you know, the actual council is the fact that now we have these two offices bickering a bit. And this is the tension that happens when you have a Democratic senator, a Republican governor's office. But oftentimes they do work well together because they are so pro-development. They are focused on the same issues. But we're seeing a crack here in how these two are related and in how the two offices are functioning together.
Let's get Matthew Felling in here. Matt.
Yeah, Libby, this is Matthew Felling from CBS 11. I understand that part of Parnell's objection, I think it was the pull-away phrase out of his press release, was basically, in a manner of speaking, nobody even asked me about this. I mean, there's a number of people that Begich's office contacted within the state. Mayor Itta from up at the North Slope. And I think he just felt a little bit left out of the process.
I was dissed?
Something like that. And I think also, I wanted to talk to you. Begich actually is flirting with Republicans with regards to a climate bill. He said, listen, I'm not a big fan of what Harry Reid's doing and posturing. And I might even be swayable to what the guys are doing on the other side of the aisle. What's happening over there?
Well, that's right. Well, first, to key up something that you said, when I asked Senator Begich about, you know, communication with the governor's office, he said, look, we've been talking on a regular basis to the governor's Washington, D.C. office and think very highly of the staff there. And so I don't know where the conversation is going from there. But according to Senator Begich, he said, we have been talking to them. So he defended that charge. And you're right. I mean, Begich is saying that he may actually vote on this Republican version of an oil spill bill. He's still, when I last talked to him, was still poring over it and said he may announce today how he'll come down. But he is really finding more in common with it than what the Democrats are pushing. And he said that the Democrats' version is really pretty thin for Alaska and doesn't include funding for Alaska-specific items. He feels like those were kind of taken out, basically. And he's concerned about things like setting a liability cap on the oil companies when they do development. The Democrats' bill calls for abolishing a liability cap. The Republicans keep the cap and has a different sort of scheme on how to come about it, and he likes that a lot more. And so we're waiting to see sort of how he's going to weigh in. And he said, yeah, I might be the only Democrat to vote for this, but you know what? I'm willing to go with it anyway. And that would, of course, be interesting because Senator Murkowski was crucial in writing this bill, so he may be joining her team in this effort.
Libby, do we know what Senator Landrieu of Louisiana, the Democrat, is saying?
Well, you know, revenue sharing is one of the big hot items that Senator Landrieu is often right on the same page with the senators from Alaska, because they want the states to benefit when oil is drilled and the feds get money. They want some of the money to get kicked back to the states. And she and the other senators have concerns because one of the Democrats' ideas is to put some of that revenue sharing money into like a land conservation fund to create more federal lands. And these guys say, we don't need more federal lands. We have enough. We want the money to go right back to the states. So there are some concerns. But now the Gulf gets a lot more in the Democratic version of the bill than Alaska does, just because that's front and center. And so she is less critical than someone like Begich is. But, you know, Begich says, look, just because we didn't have the most recent oil spill doesn't mean that we should get forgotten about. We're still hurting from Exxon Valdez. And if we're going to have drilling in our shore, off our shores, in our waters, we need to be protected and also sweeten the pot a little bit for Alaska as well.
Okay, this would be a pretty good example of the benefits contained in the bill trumping any particular ideology or attitude towards the federal government. Libby, let's keep you in here. Alaska is one of four states that did not apply for President Obama's Race to the Top education money. Why not?
Well, that's right. There have been two competitive rounds to give out over $4 billion. And winners were picked in the first round, just Delaware and Tennessee. But the second round finalists were announced this past week, 19 states. And we're not anywhere in it because Alaska just didn't apply. President Obama made a major education speech this week defending his administration's plans and goals, and talked about the Race to the Top program as actually being, in his words, the single most important thing his administration has done. So this shows the direction that the Obama administration is going in, and he was very critical of folks who aren't on board with it. The state says that it's actually a lot of work to apply for this program and takes a lot of money and may not amount to anything because it is a competitive process. Not everyone's going to get a share of those dollars. And the state says, and Alaska's not the only one, Texas feels the same way, that the Fed's formula for how they're deciding on how to give the money out really makes states kind of conform to standards that they may not want to. And the state has its own plans and its own vision for improving education. And if they have to play by the Fed's rules, it'll actually change what they're doing. And they're just, in general, not happy with the direction that the Obama administration's going with things like their solutions for turning around low-achieving schools and tying teacher performance to pay. The state says, we're on our own. We'll find our own way. Thank you very much. It doesn't mean that Alaska doesn't see any education money. There's still the regular formula funding that gets sent back there. But we're not on board with this sort of new way that the Obama administration is trying to do business. And we'll see if other states are more critical when they don't get the money.
This sounds like I'm not interested. Call me when you wise up. So we'll see how this plays out in the future, because obviously the state of Alaska is going to be interacting with the federal government and certainly wants money for education, and there will be federal policies. Matthew, and therefore C-17 crashes here in Anchorage, good weather in the middle of the evening or the early evening. What do we know happened? What can you tell us about the crash so far?
Well, I mean, one of the most ginormous aircraft out there in the Air Force fleet, C-17. Around 6:14 on Wednesday night, it was practicing for this weekend's air show, which apparently is going to be on schedule to commemorate the actions of the men who ended up perishing. It crashed and burned into a pillar of smoke and fire over at Elmendorf on the north side of the base. And there are a lot of questions being asked how this happened, why the maneuvers were so risky, was it a malfunction? We are still in the process of trying to just even get the names of those involved, to be honest. By the time this airs, that might have been changed. But I thought at the end of the night, we had a very strong statement, because when they had a press conference, it was about 10:20-ish during both KTU and KTVA's newscast, they had a press conference to say, here's what we know, which wasn't a whole lot. They could have sent out a public information officer. They could have sent out somebody with a written response. They sent out Lieutenant Commander Dana Atkins. Mm-hmm. And that was a strong statement saying, listen, we are taking this seriously. We are not going to just dismiss this as a press release. He might have had a less than stellar performance, calling it a mishap, which I'm sure doesn't mean a lot to the families involved. Also, on the topic of families, the families of people that were suspected to be on this aircraft were left at the gate. They were not allowed to come in. They had questions. They were just asking all the basic questions, and they weren't even allowed to step foot on the base at that time. So, aircraft, major, major crash in preparation for this weekend's air show, which will go on. Flags are at half staff. It's a tough story to cover, and it's a tough nut to crack too in terms of getting information out of the base.
Steve, you got all kinds of calls pretty much right as it was happening from people who saw this airplane and wondered if it was in trouble. Why don't you tell us about that, and tell us what you've learned about the victims.
We received, as this was going down, we announced during our newscast what had happened, as much as we knew anyways, you know. And we received a number of phone calls from people and some emails who said that this aircraft had come right over their home. There was a woman in particular in Rabbit Creek area that said the jet had come over her house. Some other folks had called and said the whole house was rattling. They thought it was an earthquake. Other people reported just seeing it come across the hillside as well. And again, total conjecture whether or not that this was all part of what led up to this crash, or if it was just, again, practicing for the maneuvers it would show on Saturday during the open house. So a lot of question marks. The military, very methodical in these kinds of investigations. They're not going to speak until they really are sure of what just happened, exactly what happened. So probably not going to be a lot of speculation or conjecture at all, or information leaking out until
Steve,
they know exactly.
Do we know approximately how long after takeoff or how long the plane had been aloft?
No, I haven't heard that myself. There were questions about, you know, did this airplane develop some kind of trouble? And when it flew over the hillside, was it coming back to try and land? Was it doing touch and go? So from what Lieutenant General Atkins had said, he said it was shortly after it had taken off. And then it went down, he said, during this news conference. Again, he was at Eielson Air Force Base earlier in the day. He said he had just gotten off a plane. He was still trying to play catch up with the information. And so there wasn't a whole lot that he was letting on at that particular point in time. Now, about a half hour or so before we started taping here on Friday, we did get word on the people, the identities of the people who are on board, and we can tell you that Major Michael Freeholz and Major Aaron Malone, they were pilots assigned to the Alaska Air National Guard's 249th Airlift Squadron. Captain Jeffrey Hill, he's a pilot assigned to Elmendorf's 517th Airlift Squadron, and Master Sergeant Thomas Sicardo. He was with the 249th Airlift Squadron. He's a loadmaster. Those were the four gentlemen killed in the C-17 crash at Elmendorf. So we now know the identities of the four people on board. And Alaska has always had a very strong connection to the military here. And I'm sure that folks here will step up and give the military the kind of support it needs to get through this tragedy.
It's going to be an emotional scene at the air show this weekend, and probably one of the most highly attended ones, I would have to think. And I'm glad that the military put out that statement, because you were right, the conjecture and the speculation. We get 10 to 15 phone calls or tweets into the newsroom for basically every one that we can actually nail down. So it actually became a wonderful example of new media helping us. Yeah. And at the same time, you want to check out all these different things. And we got all the information out. It was a difficult, long, long night. And we're going to have to see how it shapes up this weekend. And also, it affected the Alaska Railroad traffic, because the Alaska Railroad was affected by the debris from the crash. And for at least until late last night, around midnight, no trains were going north or south. So that's probably going to have made a small dent in the state's economy, and the cost, the dollar figure, is yet to be determined.
Thank you, Matt. Thank you, Steve. I'm going to step down from my role as moderator and be a panelist here briefly. Judge John Sedgwick of the Federal Circuit Court here in Alaska held a status hearing on the case of legislator Bruce Wyrock, who is charged with corruption. He met in his chamber or in his trial room with lawyers for Wyrock and lawyers for the government. The hearing lasted all of 5 minutes, gentlemen, ladies, as Judge Sedgwick concluded that the trial was not ready to move forward on September 13th. That the Ninth Circuit, which now technically has the case, the Wyrock case, has been remanded to them for the Supreme Court. We'd have to hear what they might have to say in trying to tailor the findings of the Supreme Court to the particular circumstances of Wyrock and answer the question, which originally had gone up to them from Judge Sedgwick, of what evidence that the federal government was suggesting could be admitted. This is in Attorney Doug Pope's memo, if you want to call it, to the court. That's not the technical term, but folks get the point. So they agreed that they weren't ready to move forward, and there will be no trial on September 13th, and it looks like the Wyrock corruption matters will go into the year 2011, and we can all go back down there sometime then. Now, maybe they can get it done by Christmas, but in this league, I don't think anybody'd bet on it. Okay, let's get back to Libby Casey. Libby, EPA Administrator Lisa Jackson was here in Alaska this week. Why was she here, and if she said anything of import publicly, what was it?
Well, I want to commend my colleagues at stations like KYUK in Bethel. Shane Iverson was reporting from out there. And in Dillingham at KDLG, Mike Mason did stories about Administrator Jackson's visits. It's thanks to their reporting that we know what's going on in such a big state, which is really exciting. Jackson's visit's part of the Obama administration's effort to strengthen travel relations and really get out to rural America and see that as well. And she went to a couple of villages in the Southwest, including Chifornac. And Shane reported that out there, you know, she met with the tribal council and expected to hear a lot about water and sewer problems, because they don't have plumbing out there. But instead, she heard about erosion. And instead of going to her and saying, look, we need to solve the honey bucket problem, they said even more important on our list right now is the erosion we're seeing in our village and how climate change is affecting our community. And that, I think, was a powerful message, it sounded like, for her to receive. And it's interesting because, of course, right now, Alaska's senior senator, Lisa Murkowski, is battling fiercely with Lisa Jackson over the climate change issue because of the EPA's plans to phase in regulation of emissions from stationary sources like power plants. Murkowski doesn't want that to happen right away. She doesn't think it's up to the EPA to make that decision. And so here was Jackson in rural Alaska hearing people say, well, do something about climate change, please, because it's really affecting our lives. Over in Dillingham, she heard from people there about the Pebble Mine Project, from folks on all sides of that issue, including, tribal leaders, government leaders, the heads of Native corporations, to get a sense of what's actually going on out there. And she also did meet with the groups who are working to push the development of that project.
Steve, we have about 40 seconds. Is there any way you can summarize what's going on in the governor's race?
No.
How about
actually,
more of the same?
Actually, it's been
is more
quiet.
Of the same.
Yeah, I think if you right now, a few polls out there, Parnell, Berkowitz seem to be leading on their respective sides. If you look at the APOC statements, it is Parnell who's raised the most money. I think one of the trends that you see too is you've got Ralph Samuels, who started off really strong with his fundraising, kind of flattened out over the last 6 months.
One thing I noticed, I was in Fairbanks for a few days, and Mr. Walker was working the crowds very hard there during the Golden Days festivities. Yeah. That was quite noticeable. We are about out of time. Thank you for joining us. We'll see you right here on Anchorage Edition next week.
At Anchorage Edition at kakm.org or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Anchorage Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.